everyone. My name is Aarti, and this is the Mahabharata. Episode 64, Two Men and Two Babies, also available online at www.themahabharatapodcast.com or facebook.com/themahabharatapodcast. In our last episode, we concluded the story of one matricidal, genocidal, and, as King KV succumbs to his injuries, regicidal, Monsignor Ram Jamadagnya, a.k.a. RJ of the Axe, who avenged his father's murder by killing 21 generations of Kshatriyas before his ancestors finally staged an intervention. As RJ headed for grief counselling, we lay awake, puzzling over matters of anatomy. King KV had 1,000 arms, but how many sockets? What muscular adaptations prevented him from just toppling over every morning? A stomach sleeper or starfish? We'll never know, but we do know RJ subsequently retires into the mountains. We'll see him again, we already have, but he'll be a subdued figure, suffering rather an identity crisis. Studies have since revealed daily bloodbaths are not nearly as good for mental well-being as for complexion. So in book one, we saw RJ trains Drona in the martial arts. That makes sense given Drona is a Brahmin. But we also saw RJ trains Bhishma in the martial arts. That makes less sense given Bhishma is all war waging, woman napping, neighboring kingdom storming, Kshatriya. Yet, just when his therapist will congratulate him on having turned the page on his Kshatriya vitriol, RJ will be triggered again by Karana, whom he'll curse for being a Kshatriya. Now, I know what you're thinking. At least he didn't kill him. You're saying in your glass half full, silver lining, bright side of life kind of way. Ah, but whispers have been circulating. You see, maybe he just can't kill again. Remember how Tony Soprano, after a trailblazing career in the mafia arts, was afflicted with PTSD? So we'll see how in book five, RJ failed Amba, forced into ignominious retreat, unable to defeat just one solitary Kshatriya. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Today, let's see. We're pacing the paternity ward, anxiously awaiting the first warbling wail of an immaculately conceived, wonder-making, anatomy-confounding infant. What a story this is, Anderson! The CNN reporter chatters as the battalion of news hawks bides time, pouncing on every hapless orderly for a morsel of news. A man giving birth. It's inconceivable. Or at least before today, it was. Nobody knows quite how this is going to work. There's an army of OBGYNs attending King Yuvaneshwar's labour. The hospital's on high alert. Ultrasounds have not been able to determine the precise location of the baby. But that baby there is certain. The last update assured us of a gallopingly powerful fetal heart rate. There's a thrill of expectation among the commentariat, and though there have been a few false starts to King UV's labour, physicians have confirmed that this is the one. The singular nature of the case has spawned entire careers in documentary filmmaking. Suddenly, reproductive issues are top of mind, and now the Smithsonian Channel is in on the act with an in-depth study of reproductive anomalies reported cross-culturally. Something about this magnificent landscape, the narrator relates in tranquil tones, breeds the miraculous. The pristine waters of the Himalayas, the rich alluvial soil of the plains, the pulse-rich diet of the natives, the holy vegetarian lifestyle. She's positioned herself strategically out of sight of the McDonald's. India has historically reported an astonishing number of parthenogenetic births. Though some scurrilous scholars have insinuated there was a crisis of male infertility, I don't think you can call them scurrilous on primetime television, the producer interjects bluntly. But the narrator's a passionate Indophile and stubborn and filled with indignation at what she deems an affront to the virility of the great nation. Marxist? Feminist? Feckless iconoclasts? How about just scholars? The narrator thinks furiously. Skeptics, then. Better still, cynics. She resumes her serene narration. Though some godless cynics have implied there might in the distant past have been a crisis of male infertility, as we can see, this is clearly belied by the population numbers. This is, after all, the land of the Kama Sutra, the land where once, from the purest living, women had hundreds of children, even thousands. King Sagar's one wife alone gave birth to 60,000 sons. Children grew in pots, they grew in weeds, they could walk and talk as soon as they were born. This is God's own blessed earth, the land of miracles. And, with excitement now, this is the land where men can have babies. Our expectant father, King Yuvanashva, let's call him Yuvi for short, was an all-around great guy. His friends love him, his kingdom's doing fine. He's spry at state affairs, monitors market fluctuations indefatigably, funds infrastructure and welfare programs, and has a national initiative around universal health care. But cruelly and inexplicably, he has no children. No idea why. He's been married many years. His friends already have teenagers, some have kids headed to college, but his courtyard remains barren, mocking his years of heroic toil. In despair one day, he takes to the forest. Time to pull out the big guns, he decides. He's going to immerse himself in tapas. That's how the ancients did it. It's how one Siddhartha Gautama got his start. And look at him now. He's the Buddha. It's how Vardhman Kashyapa became the great Mahavira. It's also how the obstreperous Rishi Vishwamitra finally became an almost, not quite, maybe, possibly, almost there Brahmin. Why not him? He's going to stand on one leg, raise his arms above, expose himself to heat and cold, starve, in short, faithfully tick through the entire list recommended in the Beginner's Guide to Asceticism. But tapas, it turns out, is thirsty work, the more so in the dread Indian heat. He's not packed electrolytes or water bottles. Real yogis don't need that kind of thing. A couple days in the hot sun, and King Yuvi's body starts to shrivel with thirst. Soon, every cell in his body screams for water. His mind is near delirium from dehydration. At imminent risk of renal failure, he stumbles into Rishi Bhrigu's ashram. Yes, that's our Rishi Bhrigu we've met before, husband to Paloma, father to Aunt Helchivan in our last episode, tree-hugging advocate and great-granddaddy to axe-wielding RJ, who's still out there somewhere. In a state of dire distress, King Yuvi stumbles into Rishi Bhrigu's ashram. The sun is blazing. Every sensible creature's on siesta. He calls out weakly, but his voice is like the squeak of a dying bird. In the distance, he spies an earthenware pot full of delicious cold water. With the abandon of a man near nipped by death, he drops to his knees and drinks, and drinks, and drinks the precious life-giving nectar. Then, near intoxicated with relief, he collapses. When the sages awake, they find the water pot empty. What has happened? Demands Rishi Bhrigu. Who's responsible for this? Rousing himself from a luxurious sleep, the king answers truthfully that he had drunk the water. What have you done? Gasps the Rishi. That water wasn't for you. It was holy water that I'd consecrated for your wife so she could give you a son. The king is sheepish, apologizes. Email must have gone to spam, etc. Well, there's nothing to be done now. Rishi Bhrigu is very annoyed. You drank the water, so you'll carry the child. That's just how it'll have to be. And so it is that King Yuvi finds himself, yes, expectant with child. It's embarrassing to begin with. His wife has questions. But a baby's a baby, and soon she's on board assisting at Lamar's, and he's glowing through his pickles, trailed everywhere by scientists with clipboards. A medical epiphenomenon in its own right, a uterus has self-engineered around the fetus. Weeks pass, and then months, and after what feels like 100 years with doula, doctor, and midwife in tow, zero station, announces the OBGYN. The baby was to be delivered, clean C-section to the left side. CNN's Dr. Sanjay Gupta will help analyze for the medically unlettered. Not unprecedented. Remember, the Buddha also presented through his mother's side. But the idiopathy here presented much higher risk, so doctors were prepared for every eventuality. But an astonishing thing, Anderson, it took hardly a minute. Minimal discomfort, no blood loss, a spontaneous delivery. The medical community will be studying this for a long time. A bouncy baby boy is the lead in papers around the world, and the BBC's Stephen Sackers interviewing the god Indra, who's down for a visit. Well, the king suffered so much, you know. Pregnancy's hard for a man. I wanted to give him a gift. The chief of the gods is warm and affable, all Beckham charm and rich wool suit. He'll never need to nurse the infant, because I let him suckle my forefinger. For this reason, he'll be named Mandhater and will be a turner of the wheel, a world conqueror. While he has him on the set anyway, Sacker decides to ask about the inequitable distribution of wealth in the universe. But with a puff of smoke and a laugh, the chief of the gods disappears. Mandhater. The clerk completes the birth registration. The nourishing contents of Indra's finger will elevate the child to giant proportions. He'll be a famous king, celebrated in monuments as far afield as Borobudur, ancestor of Prince Ram of the Ikshvakus, well known also to Buddhist texts. But for us, he's just passing through. So let's slip away now as father and son rest quietly. How King Yuvi fared postpartum, we know not, nor what his wife said in years of therapy. Because the circus has moved to a new story breaking downstream, the scandalous tale of one King Somak. This requires a content warning. If you've ever taken an intro ethics course, you'll recognize our next story as the runaway trolley. You're the conductor of a trolley hurtling down the tracks. Its brakes have failed, and innocent bystanders clustered foolishly close to the tracks have no clue what's going to hit them. You can save 5 people by changing tracks to another which has only 1 person. Should you do it? Or another scenario. You're a bystander, you see the runaway trolley, before you is a large corpulent figure, and you can stop the trolley by creating an unfortunate accident onto the tracks. Should you? In our story, King Somak is faced with precisely such a question, and let's say takes a bold decision in answering it. So, quick vital stat. Profession, Lord Sovereign of the Realm. First name, Somak. Last name? Question mark. duties, functions of all three branches of state. Kingdom, unknown. DOB, unknown. Okay, fine, we know damn near nothing about him, other than next of kin. He has 100 wives, you see, who, however, have no names, rather buggering up the historical record. But we do know his story. King Somuk has 100 perfectly reasonable, possibly even age-appropriate wives. Yet, after years of laboring upon them valiantly, he has no children. No idea why. He's super unhappy, and he complains bitterly to his ministers. I personally inspected and handpicked this lot, specifically so they'd give me sons. They were all certified fertile. But you see, every last one of my wives, barren as the desert sand. Talk about wretched luck. Now I'm an old man, and I have no son to support me in heaven. His ministers comfort him. But then one day a miracle occurs. One of his wives somehow gets pregnant. The event occasions some raised eyebrows, but so starved is the household for children, and so delighted is the entire palace, that no one really wants to reconcile the king's travel diary with the probable date of conception. It's a live birth, it's a boy, and there's jubilation in the city. The 100 mothers fawn over the infant, grateful to have a child. They name the baby Jantu, meaning, you know, a live person. We've all heard of a helicopter parent. Have you heard of 100 simultaneous ones? So precious is little baby Jan that his 100 mothers hover over him every second. Night and day they carry him, bathe him, feed him, delight in his every burp and gurgle. One day the king is in council deliberating affairs of state. Infrastructure repairs necessitate tax hikes. Should businesses take the hit or property owners? Then comes a blood-curdling scream from the women's quarters, followed by a volley of frightful shrieks. What has happened? What's going on? The king rushes to investigate. What's happened to the baby? Half the mothers are collapsed in hysterics. The others are urgently soaking hot towels. Servants have been dispatched to fetch the surgeon. The king takes the child. Upon inspecting him thoroughly, he finds a little red mark on his bum where an ant has bitten him. A curse on having a single child, he growls, and marches back to his council. Better I'd had none. One child is a constant worry. You never know what's going to happen when. It's an utter nuisance. He consults his advisors. What do you think? Is there any way at all I might get like 100 sons? The ministers get combing the books. There are whispers about Niyoga, that tried and tested special brand of hospitality offered to Brahmins. But that would cast doubt on the royal seed. Besides, his wives are getting up there age-wise, probably almost 30. So who knows if that would even work? Adoption's a possibility, but the king likes his genes. Then his house priest, happening upon an obscure reference in an obscure text, finds a bold solution. My lord, he whispers to him out of hearing of the others, there is one idea. It's not universally favored. Some might even disapprove. The king is digging into his dinner. Will it give me 100 sons? The priest hesitates. There's a high probability, but, well then do it. Whatever must be done, you must do it for me. Tomorrow, today, immediately. For due diligence, the priest tries again. My lord, some might call it a Faustian bargain. But the king waves him off. Get on with it, will you? And so the priest does. Early next morning, as the mothers are finishing the one child's bath, singing songs, playing peekaboo, the king appears, just taking the wee one for a walk, Nothing to worry about. Be back shortly. But the idea of being separated from the child for even a moment causes a crisis for the mothers, and they trail the king as he goes, carrying bottles and snacks and playthings. Trying to shake them off, the king picks up his pace. The mothers follow. He breaks into a jog. 50 rows of women jog along behind. He tries a couple of detours, enters a men's room, but they wait patiently outside. Finally, he realizes it's useless. There's no way he can hide it from them. And damn it, he's a king, isn't he? Why should he be afraid of a bunch of women? He strides boldly to a clearing where an altar has been set up for a sacrifice. It's good you're here, actually, he tells them. It's a very special event. Please take a seat around the fire. Once the sacrifice starts, you must inhale the smoke, and the priest has assured me it's going to make you all pregnant. We're going to have 100 sons. The women eye the ground warily. The priest approaches. Everything's prepared, my lord. All I need is the... The king hands him the infant. At once a cry goes up, and the women swarm the priest. What are you doing? Where are you taking him? What do you want with our son? The priest explains patiently, this is the way it works, ladies. We have to sacrifice this child. The smoke from his burning body will enter into your bodies, and you'll all get pregnant. Don't worry, soon you'll have a household full of children, and this one's going to be reborn to his original mother. It's a glorious thing. You should be happy. Film crews leaving Prince Mandhatar's birth will capture the ensuing chaos. Utter mayhem, Anderson. The CNN reporter's eyes are wide in shock. Nobody's seen anything like this before. Hitchcock couldn't have dreamt this up. We had no clue what was going to happen. The child in the middle, the priest and the king on the one side, the mothers on the other, there was an actual tug of war happening over the body of the baby. But the king called an armed guard. They physically tore the women away. We're now a mile outside the gates of the palace, waiting anxiously for news. Child services pulls up, the police arrive. But while they're debating points of authority, he's the king, they say. We need legal counsel. Smoke goes up from the compound of the palace, accompanied by heartrending shrieks. Little baby Jan, beloved by 100 mothers, was wrenched from their arms and breathed his last today. A shattering event no one here is likely to forget. Now, I can hear you grumbling by the water cooler. Matricide, she said. Genocide, regicide, surely fratricide and parricide as well. But this is going too far. Tiny humans should not be killed, not under any pretext. We're not going to take it anymore. But before you storm the gates of Toronto, let me explain. There's little evidence of human sacrifice in ancient India, even less of we human sacrifice, and both our perpetrators wind up in the boiling cauldrons of hell. But we have a few stories like this, and they're usually illustrating some manner of very human conundrum. In a time of high infant mortality, the desperate measures we might weigh in order to have children, or in another theme, the terrible choices we might face if we're wretchedly poor, leading us to trade our children for food. And in yet another theme, some may have had occasion to ponder, the quality of our children versus the quantity. If you remember a story from many moons ago, King Sagar's wives had the option of one good son or 60,000 vicious ones who go on to tear up the belly of the earth. What would you do? Hey, have you ever heard the tale of the 5 Pandavas and the 100 Kauravas? All that said, I swear I'll tell you only nice stories next time. Oh, okay, at least no children will die. If you'll join me for another episode of the Mahabharata.